Good afternoon, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Dale Schoengert for the Frederick Douglass Foundation.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and may I say thank you for the Court's generosity for letting me appear today on behalf of my client.
Yes, sir.
We briefed the immutability question of equal protection, and that issue really should be a pretty straightforward question for the Court, given the two components that make a trait immutable under the Supreme Court's precedent. The first component is that the class is defined by some characteristic that is solely an accident of birth, and that's Frontiero v. Richardson. The second component is that that trait is objectively determinable. That's Cleburne against Cleburne Living Center. Those two factors apply to every suspect or quasi-suspect class.
Did you say objectively discernible?
Objectively determinable.
Determinable.
So it's not based on self-identification or anything else. It's based on an objective view. You can objectively determine whether someone, what race they are, or whether their parents were married when they were born. Each immutable characteristic that has been identified by the Supreme Court shares that factor that it can be objectively determined. And that, in essence, those two factors comprise the essence of what the Supreme Court means when it says immutable. There's been some argument that, from my friends on the other side of this case, that that factor doesn't really matter that much. It's been inconsistently applied by the Supreme Court. And the argument is that because there are some traits that have been identified as suspect or quasi-suspect that can change, therefore, they're not immutable. And therefore, the Supreme Court applies that inconsistently. Well, I think that misunderstands what the Supreme Court means when it says immutable. There are five or six classes, I guess, that have been identified: race, gender, alienage, national origin, and illegitimacy, and then religion. I'll take religion first because religion is really in a class all by itself. The Supreme Court has said that its suspect class status doesn't derive from the Equal Protection Clause, it derives from the Free Exercise Clause. So, for example, in Locke v. Davy, it's 540 U.S. 712, the court discussed that. There was a free exercise claim and an equal protection claim. The court found that free exercise wasn't violated, and so for the equal protection claim, they said rational basis scrutiny. If free exercise isn't violated, that's it. It's rational basis scrutiny. So religion is in a category of its own. But for the remaining five, the Supreme Court's been clear that each of those is based on an immutable characteristic. That's Parham v. Hughes. It's 441 U.S. 347. I'm not sure if it's been cited by the parties, but at page 351, the court identifies all five of those suspect or quasi-suspect classes and says that each of them is based on an immutable trait. That was a case that dealt with illegitimacy. In the very case, that same case, the court acknowledged that a child could be legitimized if his parents were married. Counsel for the United States also noted Nyquist v. Malklet. Same thing. An alien could not be an alien anymore. He could be naturalized. But that's not what the Supreme Court means when it says immutable. Even though that's a common definition, that's not what the court means. And I think Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg addressed this exact question when she was on the D.C. Circuit in a case called Quibben v. Veterans Administration. And she wrote for the court, that was a case that dealt with World War II veterans. And the argument was that they were a suspect class, and part of the argument in support of that was that this is an immutable characteristic. You know, once a veteran, always a veteran, that can't change. And then Judge Ginsburg, writing for the court, said that's not the question that the Supreme Court asks for whether a trait is immutable. It's not that it's something that's done that can't be undone. It's something that is solely an incident or an accident of birth. And so that's what the Supreme Court means, and in addition to that, it has to be objectively determinable under Cleburne and that line of cases. Sexual orientation doesn't meet either of those two components. First, I don't think there's a whole lot of disagreement among the parties on this fact, that there's no evidence. In fact, the American Psychiatric Association itself says, we cited on page 20 of our brief, that there are no replicated scientific studies showing a biological etiology for homosexuality. And we detail those studies at page, or some of those studies at pages 20 to 25, and show that there's just no evidence of a genetic or biological component. And it might be one of the factors among many, but it's a complex phenomenon that whatever the case may be, it's clear that it's not solely an incident of birth. And so I don't think sexual orientation can come close to meeting the first component of whether it's immutable or not. The second, whether it's objectively determinable.
20 years from now, 50 years from now, someone says, aha, it's genetic. Would that change your argument?
Well,
and I'm not saying, please don't take that question the wrong way. I'm just asking hypothetically.
If they could determine that it was
scientific.
Sure, if they could determine that it was wholly genetic, I mean, I don't think many people are even making that argument. I think they're making an argument that it's maybe partially genetic, although that's not determined. But if it's wholly genetic, it'd still fail the second prong, which is that it's objectively determinable, I presume. And that factor requires, I mean, because sexual orientation is based on essentially self-identification. And that alone separates it from the other five suspect or quasi-suspect classes. And in fact, there are a variety of definitions of what constitutes sexual orientation or homosexuality. As we detail in the brief, you know, there's the Lauman study, kind of the definitive study on sexual practice, identifies three main competitors, one based on attraction, another based on experience, and another based on identification. And there's not a lot of overlap among those categories. That's why you get the statistics like the Dean and Meyer study at page 11 that depending on how you define and measure sexual orientation or homosexuality, you could say that somewhere between 1% and 21% of the population is in some way gay or lesbian, with the rest bisexual or heterosexual. That's exactly the sort of amorphous class, the undefined class that the Supreme Court dealt with in the Cleburne case. When it dealt with, that was the mental disability case, and there were a variety of definitions, competing definitions of who constituted that class, and there were unknown causes, and so the court said this is an amorphous class. The way to deal with these problems is with specific definitions, specific laws, and specific instances. It's not to declare the whole class suspect, because that, in large part, takes it out of the democratic process. I mean, strict scrutiny is strong medicine. That's why it's only been, there are only five suspect classes, and like counsel for the House said, hadn't been added to in 40 years. And so, you know, the Supreme Court applied rational basis scrutiny in Romer. The 11 circuits that have addressed this, obviously, that's you're not writing on a blank slate on this question. This is unanimously been declared as a rational basis scrutiny. And I think in large part because of this immutability characteristic. Every other suspect class has it, and it's specifically defined as an incident of birth that can be objectively determined.
Well, that's why I asked the question about genetics.
Right.
And to the extent that you're saying it has to be objectively determined, who would be the one who would make that determination as an objective finder? A scientist or an observer or a jury or a court or a legislature or citizens?
Well, I guess I'm just talking in general, because for each of the suspect or quasi-suspect classes, it's objectively determinable and obviously so in most cases. So we're born of a particular race, and we can tell that from with regard to what race our parents were.
I disagree, but go ahead.
All right, let me tackle the other ones then. Whether we were aliens or not, that was strictly an incident of our birth, and we can determine that whether we were United States citizens or not, and go down the line. So each of those can be determined with reference to an objective source. And that's where sexual orientation differs, is that it's based on self-identification. And then again, you've got the problem of defining it above that. And then in addition to that, as the court suggested in Cleburne, there's a lot of fluidity among the class. I'm not talking about reparative therapy or conversion therapy or whatever they call it. I'm talking about just natural fluidity within the class. Diamond Savin Williams study that we cited at page 25 of the brief said that in one study, 50% of respondents said they had changed their identity label at least once since first relinquishing their heterosexual identity. So the class is fluid and not objectively defined, and we think that that alone defeats the immutable prong. But I don't think in general we can say that sexual orientation is an immutable characteristic without changing, fundamentally so, what the Supreme Court means when it says immutable. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.